It is 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. This is Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the editor of the Political Insider blog, which you can find online at the AJC, is with me. We have Beth Shapiro, who is a veteran, a Democratic political consultant and pollster. She's now taken a step back. She's had it with the consulting business, but we're glad you still want to be part of this show, Beth.
Thank you.
Joe Crispino, he is, let me get this right, Joe, the Jimmy Carter Professor of American History and Southern History at Emory University. Did I miss any words in that title?
I think you added a couple extra ones.
Oh, I did. All right. And really glad to have back Jackie Gingrich Cushman. She's a Republican writer and commentator, and it's been a few weeks, so we're really happy you're back with us, Beth. Thanks, Jackie. Thanks so much for being here. All right, lots to get to on today's show. But, Jim, you know, the last time Joe Crispino was here, we really took an interesting look, I thought, at historic parallels between this year and previous presidential campaigns, because a lot of us kind of easily say, oh, there's never been anything quite like this. But the audience really responded. There are parallels that we can talk about, aren't there?
There are a good many. I think we're going to be talking about Goldwater here.
Yeah.
The last time we had a serious debate over a presidential candidate's worthiness to have his finger on the budget, on the button, I think was 1964.
Well, and that's exactly right. And Joe, I do want to start with that, of course. And one of the reasons is that, set up that race for us. Barry Goldwater became the Republican nominee over the objections of a great many people who were more in the Republican Party, more mainstream Republican Party, right?
Yeah, I think if you had asked people a year out from the election who's going to be the nominee, people would have said it had been Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was well-positioned, governor of New York, you know. There had been a draft Goldwater campaign in 1960 that, you know, the kind of ideologues within the party who were trying to move to the party of the right were very excited about. But it was surprising. You know, I mean, Rockefeller divorced his wife famously, married his secretary that, you know, lost him a lot of support. Goldwater kind of emerged because of this highly motivated cadre within the party, this conservative wing. And when he won the election, a lot of mainstream Rockefeller Republicans, Northern Republicans, New England Republicans, moderate Republicans were really concerned about where the party stood.
So there are obviously parallels and dissimilarities. Jim, I would suggest, and Joe, you should get into this one because you know better than I do, that the parallel, of course, is that Goldwater was not, he was toxic to a great many the Rockefeller Republicans in 64 because of some of his positions on issues. But unlike Trump, he was nevertheless representative. He was representing an ideological conservative wing of the party, not a complete outsider.
But it was a new wing. It was a new wing, and it was a new geography, too. I mean, yeah, we'd had experienced Richard Nixon, but this was a little bit different. I mean, this was the first race. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Joe. Where we really got a look at the John Birch Society, for instance.
In the
presidential race.
Yeah, the Birch Society organizations were very active, like in Southern California, in helping Goldwater win the California primary in 64. I mean, you're right in that it was regional. It's from the South, it's from the West, and this is making inroads within the party. That was important. But this division within the party had been around. It dated back to Taft. And Taft was the predecessor. Before Goldwater, there was Taft. So there was always, there had been for many decades, a tension between kind of moderate, mainstream, even liberal Republicans, and this more conservative wing.
But I think on both sides, if you look at both that election and then where we are currently, is that what both of those candidates brought in is kind of this excitement, this electricity, this driving force from the voters themselves, as opposed to the, quote, I'm going to say establishment, and I hate that word, but kind of traditional who's in charge at that time. So I think on both sides, regardless of whether it's, you know, on the right side for Goldwater or more mainstream, kind of different for Trump, they both energize people.
What I'm trying, maybe Beth, let me try this again. Trump is, as we're going to discuss as we move forward in the show, is there are an awful lot of mainstream Republicans who are still, even though he is on the verge of being the official nominee of the party, who are still rejecting him. But it's not because of his ideology. This is not a conservative versus moderate Republican Party. This is Trump, a genuine outsider, but who has some of the same kind of, some people would say, scary elements that people thought Goldwater did.
I think that's true. He his temperament, his fitness for office certainly scares a lot of Republicans and a lot of non-Republicans. But I think you do have to come back to the point that Joe made, and that Goldwater came out of a base in the party, whereas Trump doesn't. And I think one of the most interesting groups of voters to follow over the next few months will be the values voters, the constitutional conservatives, the groups that have made their home in the Republican Party and who really, to those of us outside the party, they have been the base of the party. What do they do, and do they? They're not voting for Hillary Clinton. I can pretty much guarantee that. But does their desire to make sure the Supreme Court remains in Republican hands, will that trump, no pun intended, their distaste for Donald Trump and enable them to
vote
for him?
All right, let's come back to that, because let's stay in 1964 for a couple more minutes. Joe, in July of 1964. The Johnson campaign put out a spot. It was produced by one of the biggest agencies in New York, Dyell, Dane, Burnback, which was an agency that really believed in Johnson. I mean, aside from whatever money they made on their client, they were definitely trying to stop Goldwater from a philosophical point of view. Confession of a Republican, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do this. Let me set it up, and then let's play a little bit of it. And I suggest this is long. It was a 4-minute spot. We're not going to play all four, but we're going to play a good piece of it because it's, I think, worth listening to. This is a black and white film with an actor sitting, looking into the camera in a chair. He's got a cigarette and he talks. It's a script, but listen and see how natural this whole thing sounds. Confessions of a Republican.
I don't know just why they wanted to call this a confession. I certainly don't feel guilty about being a Republican. I've always been a Republican. My father is, his father was. The whole family is a Republican family. I voted for Dwight Eisenhower the first time I ever voted. I voted for Nixon the last time. But when we come to Senator Goldwater, now it seems to me we're up against a very different kind of a man. This man scares me. Now, maybe I'm wrong. A friend of mine has said to me, listen, just because a man sounds a little irresponsible during a campaign doesn't mean he's going to act irresponsibly. You know that theory that the White House makes the man. I don't buy that. The hardest thing for me about this whole campaign is to sort out one Goldwater statement from another. A reporter will go to Senator Goldwater and he'll say, Senator, on such and such a day, you said, and I quote, blah, 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 whatever it is, end quote. And then Goldwater says, well, I wouldn't put it that way. I can't follow that. Was he serious when he did put it that way? Is he serious when he says he wouldn't put it that way? I just don't get it. A president ought to mean what he says. President Johnson, now, Johnson at least is talking about facts. He says, look, we got the tax cut bill, and because of that, you get to carry home X number of dollars more every payday. We got the nuclear test ban, and because of that, there's X percent less radioactivity in the food. But Goldwater, often you can't, I can't figure out just what Goldwater means by the things he says. I read now where he says, a craven fear of death is sweeping across America. What is that supposed to mean? If he means that people don't want to fight a nuclear war, he's right. I don't. When I read some of these things that Goldwater says about total victory, I get a little worried, you know? I wish I was as sure that Goldwater is against war as I am that he's against some of these other things. I wish I could believe that he has the imagination to be able to just shut his eyes and picture what this country would look like after a nuclear war. Sometimes I wish I'd been at that convention in San Francisco. I mean, I wish I'd been a delegate. I really do, because I would have fought, you know? And I wouldn't have worried so much about party unity, because if you unite behind a man you don't believe in, it's a lie. I tell you, those people who got control of that convention, who are they? I mean, when the head of the Ku Klux Klan, when all these weird groups come out in favor of the candidate of my party, either they're not Republicans or I'm not. I've thought about just not voting in this election, just staying home, but you can't do that because that's...
All right, that is a 1964 TV commercial called Confessions of a Republican. Before Joe, I want to give you the first shot, and then I want to go around and get each of you to react to the parallels that you may see. One of the things that happens in that spot, there's a brilliant moment of direction. The actor says he wishes that Goldwater could imagine what America would look like after a nuclear war, at which he says, I wish he'd close his eyes and imagine it. And then he pauses for quite a long time to light his cigarette, which gives us all an opportunity to do that very thing. Very clever direction. But that's technical. Do you see the parallels here, Joe?
Well, it's a fascinating ad. I feel like I'm watching Mad Men when I see that clip, right? You know, it's a great reminder of the sense of anxiety in the heart of the Cold War. You know, this is just 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis. 1963, a big issue in American politics had been the Test Ban Treaty, you know, banning nuclear testing. And Goldwater and the right wing of the Republican Party had been totally opposed to test ban treaty. They had been the voice on taking the fight directly to the communists, right? Throughout the Kennedy administration. And there was and on the campaign trail, Goldwater had talked about using tactical nuclear weapons in the field and these kinds of things. So people were really scared.
His running mate was Curtis LeMay?
No, that was George Wallace.
George Wallace, yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. It was William Miller was his running mate, but it was but people were really scared about someone coming from that wing of the party and that there could be a another world war.
All right, but one of the key moments in terms of how we think of today, and anybody jump in here, is I wish I'd been at that convention. I wish I could have done something about it. If you support a person you don't believe in, it's a lie.
You're going to see that one. You're going to see that one. But I will tell you, there is a difference here. When people are questioning, you do have a lot of people questioning Trump's ability to handle the office. I mean, that's no stretch. His sense of foreign policy is cartoonish, just about. His sense of the military is simply missing. But at the heart of Goldwater, at the heart was in terms of what Joe was talking about in terms of confrontation with communists, was an interventionist, a very strong one.
Absolutely.
And Donald Trump is not.
And Goldwater was twice elected to the U.S. Senate. He served 12 years in the Senate when he's running in 64.
Right. And I think the other big difference is look at who they're running against. I mean, Goldwater was running against an incumbent president. People knew what he would be like as president. He was president. They understood what that was like. Here you're going to have someone who more than likely, and we can talk about the Democratic side, but I think it's fascinating to think that we have a presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, and the Democrats are still trying to sort through their process of Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Now, it's probably will be Hillary Clinton, but that's a very different discussion in the general election when you're talking about someone who currently is president and someone who could be president, and then how those people look to the electorate in total. So I think it's similar in a few ways, but I think it's also very drastically different on the general election side.
But Beth, the one thing, again, that stands out for me is this actor in the commercial saying, if you support someone you don't believe in, You're lying. Let's listen to what Paul Ryan just said yesterday and then come to you, Beth.
I hope to support our nominee. I hope to support his candidacy fully, and I want to do that. But right now, just I got to tell you, Jake, just being candid with you, at this point, I'm just not there right now. I think that he needs to do more to unify this party, to bring all wings of the Republican Party together, and then to go forward and to appeal to all Americans in every walk of life, every background. But I think what a lot of Republicans want to see is that we have a standard bearer that bears our standards. and that unifies all the wings of the Republican Party. It's time to go from tapping into anger to channeling that anger into solutions. It's time to set aside bullying, to set aside belittlement, and appeal to higher aspirations.
All right, so the Speaker of the House says, I'm not ready to support Trump at this point. George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush have said they won't go to the convention, and their spokespeople have said they will not support Trump for president. I see some parallels there between that 64 commercial.
There definitely are. I think one of the oldest cliches in politics is that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And right now it's a pretty short line that's forming behind Donald Trump. And I do think, coming back to that point about supporting someone who you don't believe in and it's a lie, we had 15 other candidates running for president on the Republican side. And up until the very end, not a one of them would take on Donald Trump. And so we had several months worth of time for the more establishment Republicans to make a case against this man and why he's not fit to be president. And up until the last month or two, that really wasn't happening. So I understand why the Republicans are upset. I do think they have nominated, they're about to nominate somebody who's spectacularly unfit to be president. But they had a chance to stop him, and many strong former and current elected officials didn't do that.
Yeah, with Paul Ryan, I think, number one, you do have the Washington establishment asserting itself here, telling a nominee that, yeah, you won the game, but not the whole game. We still control a large part of it. You also have a House Speaker who's I'm sure, is trying to protect his majority, because a poor Trump campaign is going to reflect in House and Senate elections.
One more point.
This is amazing because Paul Ryan is chairman of the Republican National Convention. Okay. He's going to be running the show, and he's not ready to back the star.
He's the host of Donald Trump's
party.
Yeah,
I think a couple of things that happened. First of all, the speed at which Ted Cruz stepped down, I think, shocked everybody, including Cruz's supporters, including Donald Trump, including and then Kasich went right after him. So I think you have a timing issue. If you listen to Paul Ryan, he's a very good speaker. I think very highly of him. But if you look at him when he says, I'm being candid, I think he was being candid, and I think he responded as Paul Ryan, the person, and the congressman rather than the speaker. I think he made a mistake. I think he could have said that same thing in a dozen different ways that wasn't about Trump the person. That would have been much, much cleaner for the party, but he said it, and that's the way it is. But I do think in the end, what's happened is you have a nominee, Donald Trump, who has energized millions of voters to come out and vote for him. And you have an establishment party that's in Washington that is terrified about losing control. And that's what you see happening. And so it's going to sort itself out over time. And I think we'll be shocked and surprised at how fast Trump learns on the campaign trail. He is very smart. If you already watch him, he's already transitioning, looking at the general election. I think it's going to be a fascinating race.
Jackie, I think you just said something really important. One of the luckiest breaks that Trump got after Indiana is it happened so soon. Mm-hmm. He has got fully 6+ weeks to try. If this had happened after California on June 7th,
you're almost there.
But he has got plenty of time now
to try
to bring people together. So I think that's a really
smart observation. I also think he has time to not only bring people together, but he has time from a personal standpoint to take a breath. Because this is an exhausting process, not just for him, but for his staff and for his family. And so for him to take the time to take a breath, to reach out and coalesce around certain key areas, I think is very important. But I think you'll see a very different Donald Trump going in the general election. And again, I go back to, if you look at the 64 race, what it also brought us was Ronald Reagan in October with a time for choosing, which was an incredible speech and launched Ronald Reagan.
All right, Ben, you want to get it?
Well,
comment in?
I think we've already seen the 2016 version of the 1964 commercial, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton, the Clinton campaign has already put out a commercial using the words of the Republican candidates themselves against Trump. So, I mean, that's already, it's already out there.
We're at Politics GPB, if you want to reach us on the Twitter. And Kevin just did. He asked if we'd post a link to that commercial.
Actually, if you go to on AJC.com, go to the Political Insider, It is in the morning jolt, second item down.
You can also go to gpbnews.org.
Oh, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that.
All right, let's do this. Let's keep talking for a few more minutes. We got to get a break in, but let's talk history one more time. Joe, there are a lot of people who say one of the things that's so interesting about the Trump campaign is that this is a complete outsider. This is a guy with no political background. We've never had anything quite like this before. He's going to own that convention. He comes from nowhere. Well, maybe that has happened before.
The Republican Party presents a united front following the bitterly contested 25th Republican National Convention, which saw General Eisenhower win over Senator Taft on the first ballot, 845 to 280. The two chief rivals clasp hands in a symbol of party harmony after the senator's announcement that he relinquishes presidential aspirations. A tumultuous convention greets the nomination of the general who has become Mr. Eisenhower following his resignation from the Army. A second ovation follows when Senator Noland of California pays tribute to the vice presidential nominee.
And who would that vice presidential nominee have been?
Richard
Nixon. I propose that this is an example of a sort of a Trump-like figure, a complete outsider. Obviously, General Eisenhower was a military man coming in and taking a party by storm. You don't quite agree with that, right?
There's surface plausibility there, Bill.
Well, that's us. I'm radio
beneath
and TV.
The surface, and it all falls apart. What happens in 52 is there's a long tradition in American politics of military men becoming presidents. I mean, George Washington himself was a general who becomes president. Andrew Jackson, Ulysses Grant. And then that's what you have with Dwight Eisenhower.
General Custer was aiming for 1880.
Boy,
well, he would have been positioned for it, absolutely, the boy general. But that's the tradition that Eisenhower comes out. And when you've been the Allied commander, you know, the commander of the Allied forces that saved the world from Hitlerism, you know, you've got a track record to run for president. So I think that's a very different thing than Trump, who, comes entirely out of business, absolute no experience, has bankrupted four companies, as the Democrats often say. But it's just there's no precedent that I can think of.
Well, I would say the precedent here is in Georgia. I mean, and it's a very smaller scale. But if you look at the tone and what the electorate wants, they want someone from who's outside. They are tired of, quite frankly, both parties. They're tired of the current Republicans in power. They're tired of the Democrats who are in power. They want someone that's fresh and new, and that's what we ended up getting with David Perdue. So I think you've seen in terms of an outsider, a need for someone different, a fresh face, that kind of drive. That's exactly what you're seeing behind Donald Trump, which I think is going to make it really fascinating in the general when you have Trump, who's clearly an outsider, someone totally outside, you know, who you would think. And then you have Hillary Clinton, who is, you know, been around for decades.
Yeah,
many people
sure.
can't even remember, well, you know, her not being around.
I'm not sure Democrats would say they're looking for an outsider in Georgia. Hillary Clinton won this state by a pretty big margin.
Not in Georgia, but that's why Bernie Sanders is doing so well.
I think that somewhere in Kansas, former President Eisenhower is probably turning over in his grave to think that he's being compared to Donald J. Trump. They were both outsiders, and that may well be where the comparison begins and ends in terms of.
You're telling me that Trump Towers and D-Day don't match, don't compare?
Well, perhaps General Eisenhower may have said, "You're fired," to Adolf Hitler, but that may be the only place where there's a parallel.
But this idea about businessmen coming in, you're right, this has happened at the state level.
Which is why Jim Barksdale is running, you know, for Senate this time. I mean,
yeah, we had David Perdue win. Go ahead.
But already, when you see in that speech that Trump gave the other day about what his first 100 days would look like, you begin to see already how different it is being running a company and being in the White House. You can't do that. You've got a Congress. You've got all these other powers and restraints.
And I do think that, so we can get to it later about who ends up as his running mate, but I do think that makes it more important because, to your point, he's entering a system that's totally different than any system he's used to. So who his advisors are, who his running mate is, I think that does make a big difference.
One of the things that is going to happen, certainly in the general election campaign, because it's been happening on the Republican side of the presidential race so far, is the argument, it's time for a change. In 1952, it was a change from the Democratic administration of a Harry Truman. I just thought for fun, we should listen to one of the spots that the Eisenhower campaign ran to promote that outsider or that change message.
Eisenhower answers America.
The Democrats have made mistakes, but aren't their intentions good?
Well, if the driver of your school bus runs into a truck, hits a lamppost, drives into a ditch, you don't say his intentions are good. You get a new bus driver.
Hi, Jim Galloway. I love that. Why can't we have commercials like that again, please?
In black and white.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be in black and white. I don't know that that's quite the parallel that I'd be looking
at. It was just for fun.
It was just for fun. All right.
Jim's not used to having fun.
let's take a break and we'll come back and we'll keep talking.
The middle-aged are among the highest at risk for opioid addiction. People aged 45 to 64 make up about half of all drug overdose deaths.
They're taking longer-acting opioids. They're taking doses that at certain thresholds are associated with increased overdose death.
How opioids are taking a toll on an older demographic. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's 3:32 on Friday afternoon. With me, Emory University History Professor Joe Crispino, Jackie Cushman, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway. We're looking at historical parallels, and I'm getting really beaten up by this panel about the ones I've chosen, so I'll try again. Joe, we're now the West Virginia primaries are next week. Hillary Clinton has really put herself behind the eight ball in West Virginia for a comment that she made a while back in which she, certainly not in West Virginia, said, talking about energy policy and that, when I'm president, we'll put a lot of coal miners out of work. And of course, that comes back to haunt you in West Virginia. It's like Ted Cruz talking about New York values away from New York. So we also have Donald Trump competing in West Virginia. He just won a mine union endorsement there. And although West Virginia is not crucial this time around, the issue of presidential candidates appealing or trying to appeal to coal miners does take us back to the 1960 Democratic primary, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was a critical primary in the 1960 Democratic race because West Virginia it was a poor state, but it was also a predominantly Protestant state. And how is Jack Kennedy, the first Catholic to run, you know, since Al Smith in 28, how's he going to fare in West Virginia? And the thing that Kennedy had was star appeal. You know, the early on, most West Virginia voters didn't even know he was Catholic. They only kind of learned that, but they knew it. They'd seen him on TV. He's boyish. He's got charisma. And he ended up winning the state relatively easily. But that was a critical moment for Kennedy to kind of show that he could appeal in a Protestant place, in a Protestant state like that. And it helped him secure the nomination against Humphrey.
And he did work hard to win coal miner support. Let's listen to a little bit from a newsreel of the time.
What are your plans if elected president for the situation existing in the coal mines in West Virginia?
Well, I think that and I've been in the Congress now for 14 years, and the fact is that in my own state of Massachusetts, we've had a similar problem because we've lost all our textile industry. And the same problem which has hit West Virginia, which is the loss of employment in the mines. And I had a chance to talk to some of the active members of the union the other day. A good many of these countries, particularly now France and Germany, where you could ship American coal over there and sell it cheaper, they refused to take it in. They put up trade barriers against it, particularly in Germany. I think that we can persuade them, and I think that the State Department and the influence of the presidency has to be used to persuade them to accept American coal. We buy a good many things from them. They have to at least be willing to buy, particularly in an industry which is so hard hit.
So, Jim, that's Kennedy. He's standing in a little circle of coal miners who've just come up from the mines. Their faces are all dark and greasy, and talking to them.
About trade.
About trade.
Trade deal.
Exactly.
Bad trade deal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Good for you. Yeah,
Right. There's another. What's interesting here too is that during that campaign, Hubert Humphrey was the main opponent of Robert Kennedy, and of course he was a populist. He was out of Minnesota, and you would have thought that would have been a much more natural fit. Whereas he was we're the rich guy.
Well, that was exactly right. Because in 1960 in West Virginia, if Hubert Humphrey had beaten John Kennedy in that primary, most people agree that Kennedy could not have won the White House. Humphrey would have been the Democratic nominee.
That's right. Well, that's what many people think, and it was true that Jack Kennedy was Joe Kennedy's son, rich boy, been born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Joe Kennedy spent a lot of money in West Virginia in advertising and campaigns and other things like that.
So, Beth, to bring it up to today again, Hillary Clinton makes that, what she has now tried several times to very sincerely apologize for. Apparently it hasn't worked very well. And Trump has really taken advantage of that. And he's going into West Virginia and saying, when I am president, we're going to bring back all the coal jobs. There's not going to be a return to the coal industry in this country. This is one of those promises that under scrutiny is not going to hold up.
And I think that was the point that Hillary Clinton was trying to make as inartfully and as clumsily as she made it. Talk about words that you wish you could take back. The reality, though, is that West Virginia hasn't gone for a Democrat since 1996. So it's not a state that she has lost herself in the general election. The problem for her, though, in terms of that comment about coal miners, is that there are coal miners in places like Kentucky, which is not normally a Democratic state, but places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and a couple of swing states that people, that Donald Trump in particular, is saying, well, look at the new voters I brought in, and I've got a chance to win in these states. And I think the problem with looking at it that way is that, yes, Her comment may hurt her in a Pennsylvania or in Ohio. Trump's appeal to working class white voters in particular who feel left behind will help him in those states. But you also have to factor in the voters, the normal Republican voters who will not be voting for him, the ones who will either sit on their hands and not vote, or who'll the moderate suburban women in particular who may well pick up a ballot and vote for Hillary Clinton. So I think it's a comment that didn't help her, but I don't think it's going to hurt her as much as some people may be thinking it will.
See, and I think the challenge that Hillary Clinton has with this comment is it shows the side of her which isn't appealing to people, which is she comes across as very cold and calculating. I mean, she's very smart. She's very hardworking. She knows her policies, but she doesn't get, you don't get that feeling like you do with Bernie Sanders. When you hear Sanders, you think you know he cares about people. He's really talking to the people and part of the people. You don't get that feeling with Hillary Clinton, and that's a challenge that she has. Secondarily, I think if you look at where we are from an economic standpoint, we're currently, our labor participation rate is at 63%. It's 4 percentages lower than it was during the Bush years. We have people that aren't participating in the workforce. So whether it's coal, whether it's coal workers, whether it's people that need jobs, I think the appeal that Trump has, regardless of the specifics, is that they believe, and he talks about wanting to get people jobs, wanting to get America moving again, wanting to help with the economy. And I think for a lot of people, that's very appealing, because when they hear him say that, they hear him talking about them as people who need jobs. So again, I think it's a bigger issue with Hillary Clinton, because it does underscore the challenge she has, which she can come across as very cold and calculating.
Jim, I think, again, Jackie makes a point that probably sums up what the problems are that she has with him. On the other hand, again, this is a guy who has cruised through the primary without many people challenging him as closely as he's going to be challenged in the general election, certainly in the debates. And the question is, his general desire, let's even give him credit, let's say this is his aspirational goal for America. He believes it deeply, but he's very, very he's not forthcoming when it comes to details.
And you have to wonder, I mean, there was, where was I reading this? It was, Mark Cuban. I don't know if you were, the sports
yeah.
guy,
uh-huh.
who is suggesting that what Trump is going to have to do, there's no way he can gain a grasp of all these complicated issues in the time limited to him. He's going to have to run a kind of a Jerry Seinfeld campaign, a campaign about nothing. That's almost a campaign about feelings and intuition.
But the problem with that for him is that you can try that, But then people start to look around you and ask, well, who's advising you? Who will you turn to? It's clear that you don't know as much about these issues as your opponent does or as many other people do. So who are you going to turn to, and who have you turned to? And he really has no team of serious advisors that he's put together on foreign policy, domestic policy, or anything. So there's just not a lot about him that gives a voter confidence that once he's in the White House, if you're in the White House, that he'd be getting good advice and would know what to do.
All right, let's put it. Do you want to make a response?
All I would say is we're getting back to that 1964 Confessions of a Republican.
Yeah.
You've got all this anxiety out here about Donald Trump and his worthiness to be president, and it's going to be the Democratic job to make sure that anxiety hangs out there.
I think they've already started, and I think they will be making sure that.
Yeah, but the challenge is the Democrats in 64 had a sitting president. They don't have that this time. They have a terribly flawed candidate who is untrustworthy, who has decades of experience in government, who a lot of people, quite honestly, would do anything not to have her in office. So I think it's a very different. I don't think you can compare a 64 general with the current general election at all.
But if Hillary was calculating, the calculating thing to do in West Virginia would be to say that you support coal miners. In some ways, you know, this is what happens whenever you're running for president. You say one thing in one state, it's going to make somebody else in another
New
state
New York mad. Values.
You know, you got to go to Iowa and talk about ethanol. And you got to, yeah. You know, you got to talk about coal miners. In some ways, it's talking honestly. You know, straight talk to the people. We're not going to be able to build an economy around coal. We got to have clean energy and that kind of thing. So the one other thing about Hillary in West Virginia, it just shows how fickle politics is, because in 2008 she ran great.
She
in West Virginia,
clobbered,
she clobbered
Barack
Obama
Virginia.
Among the Appalachian voters.
Yeah. And now she's going to lose to Bernie Sanders, and I mean, so yeah. Sanders yeah. is going to take that, and you know, one more step between Debbie Wasserman Schultz or whoever to get to contest
the right,
convention.
So think about that, Joe Crispino. Bernie Sanders, a socialist, goes to West Virginia and is received really well by working men and women of this country. And I suddenly see Roosevelt in the Depression with working people of that era. Does that make any sense to you? I mean, it's the picture I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, you know, Sanders has got tremendous support within the party. And I don't think he's going to drop out. I think he's going to stay until every vote is counted. And I think that's his right. And it's probably, in the end, it's probably going to be a good thing for the Democratic Party, because it's going to let, you know, complete the process. But, you know, what's remarkable about Sanders is his fundraising model, to where he can stay in. You know, he has this relationship that he's built up with his voters through social media, and he gets money through them. And, you know, usually when it looks like the race is over and the other side is consolidating, everybody drops out, the money dries up, and so you combine forces. Bernie doesn't have to do that.
All right, let's talk about money, Jim Galloway. Trump, Joe already referred to it. Trump this week talked about a few things that are going to change as he moves into general election mode. He did talk about the first 100 days. He'll have the plans for the wall in place. That was certainly a big one. Yes, he's going to start moving forward and figuring out how to deport millions of Hispanics. I mean, he hasn't changed his tone on those things, Muslim ban. But he also talked about the fact he now knows he's going to have to raise money in a way that he says he hasn't before. He has raised money. It isn't all self-funding, but now he's really got to turn to big fundraising dollars.
In fact, very little of it has been self-funding.
Right.
He has loaned himself money.
Right.
And with the prospect of being paid back by somehow, one would think, through fundraisers and donors there. But he's also going to have, I mean, look, I mean, the what is the name of the Hillary super PAC that just came up with $91 million?
Yeah.
Priorities
USA. Thank you. And I mean, they have just laid out a 6-month strategy of spending for $91 million. And there's right now on paper, there's no Trump answer to that, simply because Trump has kind of pushed away all the money. You have the Koch brothers saying that they don't want any part
of it. Yeah, but you've now got Sheldon Adelson saying, gee, I think Trump's not bad after all, which is fascinating because Beth, as you know, the Jewish world was adamantly opposed to Donald Trump back when he said, well, I want to be a fair broker. I don't want to take sides in Israel. And now you've got arguably the biggest brand in Republican politics, or in terms of money people, Sheldon Adelson saying, yeah, I think I can support Donald Trump.
You know, it's amazing how the dislike of an opponent can help mm-hmm. unify people. And I think that's why when my Democratic friends, of which I have many, many, and I even have some Republican friends, but when my Democratic friends start measuring for the drapes in the White House because they think that Hillary will easily beat Trump, I think that my caution to them and to anybody who thinks that the race is over is that Hillary Clinton is a polarizing figure, and that the dislike for her will bring votes back over to Trump, voters who right now are thinking, I can't vote for him.
All right, we got to get a break in, but real quick, Joe, couldn't you talked about the Bernie Sanders model? Isn't that an option for Donald Trump? He's got these millions and millions of people out there who support him. If he's going to have trouble with the big money people who he's, you know, been criticizing throughout the whole election cycle, couldn't he start a same kind of drive that Bernie Sanders has had?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's definitely a kind of model that would. That would not seem to be possible.
But Delaware is making faces.
No, but it's a model that Bernie Sanders, his social media model is driven by young people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's an age dimension to it.
And that's the group that Donald Trump just can't reach right now.
This is why I have experts sitting around the table. Tell you what, let's take a break. When we come back, two things. First of all, we want to talk vice presidential candidates. Donald Trump is in the process of thinking about them. Maybe we'll bring Jackie Gingrich Cushman into this conversation. But then we want to talk about a really powerful attack that happened against Nathan Deal out in Carrollton this week. Let's talk about whether it has any real consequence in a larger way. You're listening to Political Rewind. It's 3:47.
You're listening to Political Rewind with Bill Nigut on 18-station radio network. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, offering 55 undergraduate and graduate degree programs in more than 250 fields of study.
So Newt Gingrich, I'm sorry, we're back on Political Rewind. I should say that first, with Joe Crispino, Jackie Cushman, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway. So the Trump people say, yeah, we're starting to vet vice presidential candidates. Trump has said, I really want somebody who knows politics. I know how to do business, but I need somebody who can navigate the political world, who has experience in there. And Jim Galloway, Newt Gingrich's name pops up frequently. Should you know, Jackie's cell phone probably has Newt's number on it. Can we grab it from her?
I think you'd have to break the code to get in there.
I'm locking it.
Yeah. It's no, and Mr. Gingrich, of course, has been offering Mr. Trump some, I'm presuming, some solicited and much unsolicited advice. So
you know my father well.
So you have to put it, but I will tell you what, in my thousands of emails this morning, I did have people sending me the Las Vegas odds for Trump's running mate, and John Kasich was running 3-1. I think Newt was somewhere in the 100-1 range, about midway through the pack.
Okay. Jackie, obviously you're not going to be talking with us about this from the position of an insider. So talk to us in a more general way. What do you think Trump needs to do in thinking about a nominee? The Kasich's name keeps coming back as the possible top choice for this job.
Well, Kasich would be a great choice. I mean, he has experience on the Hill. He served as budget chair under my father when my father was speaker. So they balanced the budget 4 years in a row. That's the last time we had a balanced budget. So that would be great experience. He also has served as obviously as the governor. But I think when you look at who should be his vice president, the first one I think you have to say is who could actually be president. So I think you have to pick someone that people would feel very comfortable that if they became president. I think that's number one. And I think John Kasich fills that, as do many others. I think Nikki Haley could be a really great choice. There are several people.
I think she's ruled that out.
Yeah, I mean, Haley is also the one who refused to support him in South Carolina.
And the second thing you have to look at is you have to look at who can meld and work with Trump. I mean, Trump is going to be Trump. That's how he won the primary process. He's not going to change his personality in total for the general. So I think you have to find someone much like playing tennis. I love to play tennis. I'm not very good. But it really makes a difference who your partner is when you're playing the game. And I think he has to find someone that can work with him and support him and help him, and not someone who just happens to look good on paper, because there are lots of people who would look great on paper, but you have to find the right fit.
Would you like to see your dad be that choice?
You know, that is... we'll have to wait and see what happens. It's not neither here nor there.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah. Well, I can't. I have to ask.
But Jackie's point's a good one, is that that's become much more the model for vice presidents these days, is that you have much more of a collaborative. Mm-hmm. You know, Jimmy Carter was the first to start that, you know, in his relationship with Walter Mondale. Mm-hmm. And you saw it through, you know, each of the administrations that followed.
Clinton did it with Gore, and it was a spectacular success, most people thought. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you're right, that the model today is not just kind of matching mm-hmm. different pieces of the puzzle,
right.
but actually getting somebody you can really collaborate with.
Beth, you want to jump in?
I think that on paper, Kasich would look like a very good choice. In reality, though, I think that as you watched his demeanor over the course of the campaign, where initially, oh, I can support the nominee, I can support the nominee, the last couple of months, he was hedging an awful lot about whether he could support Donald Trump. The other problem for Kasich is that you traditionally look to your vice presidential nominee to be the attack dog. And maybe Trump doesn't have to do that because he has that role mastered himself.
please, not more.
You look for the attack dog, and that's where, with all due respect to Jackie, where Newt Gingrich would be a terrific.
Yeah, he's a big teddy bear. Come on,
nominee. Governor Kasich would not fill that what I think is an important need in a campaign.
All right. I got to tell you that I view this sort of the way a political cartoonist would. I'd love to see a Newt Gingrich Donald Trump ticket because, oh my gosh, would we have a lot to talk about?
We'd have to decide who has the best hair.
That is a good question.
All right, let's turn.
At least one has natural hair.
Let's turn back to state politics with the little time we have left. Jim Galloway, this week you reported in Political Insider in the blog. On an interview that Kevin Cook, he's a member of the State House from Carrollton, gave to the local radio station out there, WLBB. What happened in that interview?
Well, you had a Republican lawmaker, 4-year veteran, unopposed in the primary, just take the lid off and really come down hard on his Republican leader in the Capitol. For vetoing this campus carry bill. He tied it to the similar veto of the religious liberty bill.
So let's talk about it. But before we do, let's listen to Kevin Cook talking to WLBB.
Given this governor's ability to do the right or the wrong thing, he's going to choose the latter every time. If the state's not going to allow an individual to exercise their constitutional right to keep and bear arms in a public place, I mean, this isn't private property, then the state should be compelled to provide ample security where that doesn't happen. People want to know why Donald Trump is a nominee for president. Nathan Deal is the reason why Donald Trump is a nominee for president. People are sick and tired of stinking politicians telling them what they're going to do when they get in office. And when they do that, they do the exact opposite. We're going to be stuck with him for 2 more stinking years.
Wow. All right. So, Jim, let's say this. Kevin Cook is not a leader in the State House. But the question is, does he reflect, do we think, the anger in a pretty accurate way?
I think he does, and I think what we're looking at is a forecast of the 2018 race for governor, in which you're going to have Republicans actually running against Nathan Deal, mm-hmm. a Republican incumbent. That's a pretty big deal.
I would expect Beth that the Republican state convention in the weekend of June 4th, 5th, is that those
third
that
and
first,
fourth, third and fourth,
that first weekend in Augusta. It's going to be boiling over with this kind of anger.
And I would agree with you on that. I also would expect that West Georgia College won't be getting much funding in the next 2 budgets, as we've seen happen in Columbus as a retaliation against Senator McCoon. I think that there are a lot of people who look at what Governor Deal did in terms of vetoing both of those bills, the religious freedom and the campus carry, and feel that he acted responsibly on behalf of all citizens of the state. But there are an awful lot of people who would disagree with that, disagree with it vehemently, and I think that that's who we'll be hearing from in Augusta.
Yeah, you know, Jackie, I think, Beth, I want to pick up on her point. We know, of course, that Josh McCoon is obviously the most visible leader of the religious liberty movement down at the Capitol. We know that even as the session was ending, the governor punished Columbus in the budget, we suspect because he's sending a message to McCoon. But then he did it again. During his bill signing period, he took more money away from Columbus. And, you know, he's not going to say this, but you got to speculate he's firing a warning shot that anybody wants to come back and mess with him on these two issues, he's got the budget purse strings.
Well, I think Governor Deal, I mean, he's been a very good governor from my perspective. And I do agree, actually, with both of the vetoes. I think Governor Deal made the right choice. And I think particularly in the campus carry, that was a situation where not only on campuses, but also those campuses had, child care centers on those campuses where children stay every day. And so I think it was the right thing to do to veto that bill. But I think, you know, Governor Deal is being the governor. I mean, he's saying this is where I draw my line. This is what I'm going to do. They can listen to him or not. It's their choice. But I do want to say that since my father came out of Carrollton and that's where I grew up, that clearly Carrollton has very passionate politicians.
So, Jim, there will be an effort, do we think, to have an override on campus carry when they come back to session with a new legislature?
I mean, we had David Ralston, the House Speaker, on Wednesday's show, and he didn't give any sign of it. It would be hard. The thing about vetoes is that they have to be done. That's the first action you have to take when you reconvene the session. I mean, even before you take roll, you've got to go into veto mode.
Right.
And I don't think that either of those. And I know that religious liberty didn't. I don't think campus carry had a 2/3 majority vote on either of those bills.
Okay, we are just about out of time in today's show. Joe Crispino, a little footnote as we end today's show: the actor in that Confessions of a Republican ad is a guy named Bill Bogert. Rachel Maddow is the one who brought this commercial to a lot of people's attentions. He was on her show last week, and he said, yeah, I believed everything I said in that commercial. I am still a good Republican. I'm as worried today as I was back then, but I'll always vote Republican. And then he said the last Republican he voted for was John Lindsay, who then changed parties. So, so much for
very different kind of Republican.
All right. Look, Joe Crispino of Emory, we're always glad to have you here. Jackie Cushman, Beth Shapiro, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being with us. Remember, Jim Galloway's column is in the Thursday and Sunday paper, and you can read him online at Political Insider on the AJC website. You can listen to our show on the GPB News website as well if you've missed any of the programs. It's also available to you by downloading the GPB Atlanta app or by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes. Next week on Political Rewind, we're going to bring in Jim Galloway's colleague, Aaron Gould Shinen, who's been covering the congressional races in Georgia. There have been some hot ones, some deeply contested races. The 3rd District, where Lynn Westmoreland has decided to retire from office, is one of them. So we'll give you a chance to hear a little bit more about those races. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street and Sunday, Faith Saley. You may know her as a commentator for CBS Sunday Morning, as a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's going to talk to us about what it means to be an attention junkie. That's on Two-Way Street, tomorrow at 4, Sunday at 11. I'm Bill Nigut. See y'all next time for Political Rewind.